Do you have an issues, etc. story to tell? We want to hear from you. Tell us your issues, etc. story by calling our comment line before Thursday, April 7th, 618-223-8384. Be sure to give us your first name and tell us where you're from. Now, the listener with the best story will receive the first three Issues Etc. books of the month for this year. 618-223-8384. 618-223-8384.
Well, a traditional view of natural law says that there is an objective morality founded in a creator, in God, that is accessible and known and impossible not to know for every man, woman, and child who lives. Yet we live in a postmodern age where we can't even manage to concede that there's such a thing as truth beyond my truth, your truth, and everybody else's truth, all equally competing. Is natural law dead in a postmodern age? Joining us to talk about natural law and postmodernism, Matt Cochran. He received his master's degree from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and he's author of a chapter in the book Natural Law. His chapter's titled A Way Forward, Continuing Conversations on Natural Law. Matt, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much, Todd. It's good to be here.
Until rather recently, Christians and others who believed in natural law could make the case in the public square based upon some shared assumptions that we had with even secularists on the existence of an objective truth. But postmodernism rejects even the existence of objective truth. Can we still make an argument in a postmodern age for natural law?
Well, we can. And the reason for that is that postmodernism does more along the lines of pretending to be completely relative and can be completely subjective. For example, you talk to any moral relativist who says what's right for you is right for you, wrong for you is wrong for you, but you can't force your morality on me. Well, it's really only a matter of time till they move on to that. Well, you can't force that morality on me. That is itself kind of a moral claim. They're saying it's wrong of you to do this. And what's more, they're saying that it is wrong for anybody to force their morality on somebody else. So, like with most aspects of postmodernism, it really ends up being self-refuting as long as the conversation continues. It becomes more and more apparent that it's more of a pretense than an actual principle that they're holding to, simply for the reason that postmodernism doesn't really allow you to hold to principles.
So is the first task, before we start talking natural law and its consequences in a postmodern age, is to kind of sweep away the pretense of postmodernism to say, look, everybody has at least some view of objective truth where we can begin this conversation?
You can do that, or I think the way that goes more to the heart of it is just wait for them to make a claim that only makes sense if there is objective truth, and then just remind them that that's what they've just done. And at that point, you can say, you know, we obviously both believe there's objective truth here. We obviously both believe that some things are wrong for everybody. So let's just not bother pretending otherwise or going through any of this stuff, and let's just start figuring out what's wrong, what's right.
So you're saying, essentially, when they say, don't force your morality on me or don't impose your belief system on me or your truth on me, we simply say, okay, now we agree. There is a right and a wrong. Let's discuss what's right and wrong.
Correct, yeah.
You say that there's also, that Christians aren't the only ones who are seeking out a form of natural law. Who else is doing this, surprisingly so?
Well, because laws are in on the heart, and because people really can't help making these claims about an objective moral right or wrong, people are always going to be looking for some way to come up with an ethical system that can tell us right from wrong. And one of the more popular ones nowadays is evolutionary psychology. Now, it begins by observing human nature, and then it comes up with a sort of Darwinian hypothesis for how this nature came about, and then uses that as the basis for a common morality. For example, you could take the fourth commandment, honor your father and your mother. You could say, well, we can see that in most cultures that children are taught that they ought to honor their father and mother. Most places believe that children ought to honor their father and their mother. Now, you can see how this might be advantageous in the history of evolution. For example, young humans are perhaps more defenseless against the environment, against other creatures in the environment, and so forth. And those that do obey their parents are going to be more successful. They'll live longer and eventually propagate their genes better. And so from that perspective, it would be, make a kind of sense that this behavior of obeying your parents has been sort of programmed into the human psyche. So they can sit and say, well, so all humans believe that you ought to obey your parents. And then they use that as a basis for common morality.
What's the pitfall of that way of reasoning toward a common morality?
Well, there are two real problems. The first is that it doesn't really discover anything about human nature at all. It starts with an observation, say, that children obey their parents, and then it goes on to create this hypothetical and typically unverifiable evolutionary scenario in prehistory about how that might have come to pass. They don't have necessarily have any evidence that this actually happened, but it's a plausible story given an evolutionary framework. And so it doesn't really tell us anything about human nature at all. It starts with an observation and then makes a hypothesis. And the reason this ends up causing a problem is because you still need something to bridge the gap between the way things are and the way things ought to be. This was a very famous distinction made by David Hume back in the 18th century. And just because we were programmed, allegedly, to behave a particular way via evolution doesn't mean that it is right to obey this programming. There's no reason to say, oh, well, we ought to follow this programming rather than to refuse to follow it. And indeed, the very concept of programming that you can refuse to follow is kind of odd itself. But more to the point, you still need something to bridge that gap between humans arrived this way by chance, therefore we ought to continue to act this way.
I'm wondering, even as a framework, naturalism, that is kind of where Darwinian evolution fits philosophically, really has nothing it can pin a real objective morality on. I mean, if it's just simply the way it happened for the survival of the fittest by random chance, that still, as you have just said, that will still never get you to right and wrong for everyone, will it?
Right. You always need something else to bridge the gap. And if you're a consistent naturalist and consistent materialist on the issue, you don't have a whole lot of options, and those options aren't terribly convincing, and you don't really end up in a place that's genuinely moral. For example, utilitarianism is one of the more popular ways to bridge this gap, and basically it's the idea that, you know, experiencing pleasure is good because, you know, everybody wants to experience pleasure, and experiencing pain is bad because nobody wants to experience pain. And so utilitarianism looks for rules and ethical systems by which we can maximize pleasure and then minimize pain for everybody. And first of all, that's not particularly moral. It's about, well, how do you act in your own self-interest? And that becomes apparent when you start seeing that, you know, certain horrible acts aren't only not excluded by different utilitarian systems, but can actually become necessary if they maximize pleasure and minimize pain. For example, Greg Kokel, I think you've had on the program recently, he mentioned on his website once an instance in which a woman in California was raped by her doctor while she was under anesthetic. Now, anesthetic means that you're not feeling any pain. That's what it's for. So if she didn't feel any pain and the doctor enjoyed himself, a basic utilitarianism would then have to say, well, oh, that was a good thing because it maximized pleasure and minimized pain. But of course, we all know that that's not the case. And even the utilitarian knows that that's not the case, which is why when you present that kind of issue, they will start to adapt utilitarianism in a way that will still be able to say that, oh, this rape is really a bad thing. For example, you might go to rule utilitarianism and say that rather than engaging pleasure and pain for every individual action, you come up with a system of rules that usually maximize pleasure or minimize pain. But even that still doesn't really say much about somebody who thinks they can get away with it. For example, why not make the rule, well, don't rape unless the person's under anesthetic? Why not have a slightly more adapted rule? And you can, you know, keep on batting it back and forth and come up with more and more sophisticated ways of reaching it. But what's really become apparent is that we already know that it is wrong to rape this person or to rape anyone. Whereas, and the utilitarian knows that it's wrong. Before you go through any of this detailed and complicated philosophical justification for it, you already know the answer. And natural law can account for that because the answer, it has been written on our heart. However, if you going through this rigmarole, by the end you have this very complicated system, and the most you can say about the rapist is that, well, he was arguably misinformed about the amount of pleasure that he would receive versus the amount of pain he would cause. Or he wasn't really quite as informed about his own self-interest as he really should have been. And, of course, when you're looking at some kind of horrible crime like rape, well, we know that that's not adequate. That simply is not up to the task.
Have there been other attempts? Because it sounds like what we're looking at there is an attempt to get to a natural law, utilitarianism, but deliberately leave God out of the formula. Have there been other attempts at, as you call it, a godless natural law?
Other ways of bridging the gap are contractarianism kind of comes to mind. And that's another one that you hear a lot about. It's in this very basic form, it comes down to anything that's consensual is good. Anything that violates consent is bad. And again, this one is still, it comes up short in similar ways. I mean, there are some things that we simply recognize as being wrong, which this doesn't cover at all. For example, the very concept of taking advantage of someone under a very simple consent means good, non-consent is bad, there's no such thing as taking advantage of someone, and yet we can certainly recognize that. An example of this coming up recently, there was I recall a story not too long ago about a professor who was discovered to be sleeping with his adult daughter. Now, everybody knew that this was wrong, and you can see that in the commentary on the issue, but you also saw people who were just bending themselves into these bizarre pretzels trying to explain why, on a basis of consent or non-consent alone, that it was actually wrong. And you end up with these really strange definitions of consent, and ultimately you end up with a system that cannot really account for our moral experience, for what we see and recognize as being right and wrong.
Well, we'll take a break. When we come back, more on natural law and postmodernism with Matt Cochran. We'll talk about cultural substitutes for God in natural law.
Coming Friday, April 8th, and Saturday, April 9th, Issues Etc. 24. It's a live 24-hour Bible study from 4 in the afternoon Central Time on April 8th through 4 in the afternoon Central on April 9th. Issues Etc. 24. Friday, April 8th and Saturday, April 9th. Listen live at issuesetc.org.
Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois is happy to support the Christ-centered, cross-focused ministry of Issues Etc. Join us for worship, Bible classes, youth ministry, and other opportunities to grow in Christ. We have a Christian day school for children in preschool to 8th grade. We are located at 1300 Beltline Road. Call us at 618-344-3151 or visit www.goodshepherdcollinsville.org.
Theology for Blue Collar, White Collar, and Clerical Collar. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on the 2011 International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights in Strasbourg, France.
The listeners to Issues Etc. already have had contact through the program with lecturers who will be in Strasbourg this next summer. Craig Parton, myself, Dr. Minuge, Angus Minuge, Adam Francisco, and these lecturers are people who have defended the faith, who know how to defend the faith, and who are marvelous communicators. And so, if a listener to this program wants to learn how to present the case for Christianity in a secular situation, the 2 weeks in the French Rhineland with us would be an absolutely ideal way to achieve this.
You can find out more about the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, July 5th through the 16th in Strasbourg, France, at apologeticsacademy.eu. Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about natural law in a postmodern age. Matt Cochran is our guest. He received his master's degree from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's authored a chapter in the book Natural Law. His chapter is titled A Way Forward, Continuing Conversations on Natural Law. Before the break, we were talking about godless forms of natural law, if you will. I don't think you can even call them that. What about God substitutes, in particular of late, under the guise of postmodernism and multiculturalism? There have been attempts to talk about some kind of objective morality based upon cultural mores. Talk about that, if you would, Matt.
One of the issues you run into if you try to have a culture substitute for God is that it can't say anything about the interactions between cultures, particularly in, you know, modern pluralistic America, where you have a wider culture, you have subcultures, you have different ethnic cultures within the wider culture and so forth. There's nothing in that that can really bridge the gap between any of these groups. And indeed, you know, someone goes so far in a hyper-individualistic context that everybody has their own culture, and what you're left with really isn't ethics at all. It's rather than, you know, one God which serves for everybody, or God substitute that serves for everybody, it's a bunch of individual gods that are always competing.
You say that we need to distinguish between natural law theory and natural law fact. What's the distinction? Why is it necessary?
Well, you can kind of liken it to the difference between, say, the theory of gravity and the fact of gravity. The theory of gravity, it's very helpful. It gives us mathematical formulas on how gravity works. You know, it can tell us how attraction between objects varies based on their sizes. It can predict how the force of gravity will apply in various instances and things like that. The fact of gravity would be more along the lines of that when you trip, you fall down. And there's something very similar going on with the theory of natural law versus the fact of natural law. Any good theory of natural law is going to explain how it works. It's going to talk about it, justify the theory. It's going to defend the theory. It'll describe how we know about the law written in our hearts, how we can discern that. And it can tell you, you know, what things are written on the hearts and so forth. But the reality is that, you know, not everybody is going to accept any given theory or even any theory at all. Defending a theory like this is a very complicated, very task, and, you know, it's certainly necessary, certainly in academia and even at the culture at large. But the other part of natural law is to remember that there's a simple fact to it. For example, that, you know, any normal person you encounter is going to know that it's wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings. Whether or not they subscribe to any theory of natural law, that fact is the simple reality that the law is written on our hearts and that it manifests itself in our behavior. You can count on it being there. And so the difference that makes in actually using natural law is that when you're having an argument about a particular moral precept, it's much more useful to appeal to the fact rather than the theory. Appeal to the sorts of things that they already know to be true, and that you can be sure that they do know to be true, and then use that as a common ground to build your case, rather than trying to start with Aristotle or Aquinas and, you know, try and defend a full, robust theory of natural law simply for one particular moral precept.
Simply begin by observing the patterns of moral reasoning that appear to be common throughout time, throughout culture, across all of those boundaries.
Yes, it's like Paul mentions in Romans 2, that we can see how this works in the way that we accuse others and the way we excuse ourselves from moral wrongdoing. One of the examples I give in the chapter is, you know, say, a man caught in adultery. He admits that, oh, I did wrong, and so forth. Well, then, you know, the task is already done. He knows that adultery is wrong. But even if he defends himself and says that, oh, well, it was entirely appropriate for me to do so, the way he defends himself will still reveal that he knows adultery is wrong. For example, one person might give the excuse that, well, yeah, but my wife and I, we've just grown so far apart, and we're not there for each other emotionally or physically anymore, and that's why I had this adulterous affair. When he's doing there, he's admitting that it is wrong to violate marriage by adultery, but he's doing it in such a way that he's simply really denying the fact that he's really married. He's trying to turn it into this mere technicality that doesn't really count. Or another example, somebody might say, you know, take a more open marriage approach and say that, you know, my wife and I, we have this understanding, and she understands that, you know, from time to time, we might stray or we might be with somebody else. But in the end, we both know that we're going to come back to each other, and that's where our hearts truly lie. In this case, he still knows that adultery is a violation of marriage, but he's misunderstanding marriage. He's changing it into something where it's this private arrangement between himself and his wife and can therefore be changed by either by himself and his wife as they deem fit, as opposed to an arrangement that's held in common by all of humanity. So in either case, there's still that knowledge in there, and it's apparent in the arguments that they know adultery is wrong. It's just that that knowledge is kind of turned against itself to soften and twist little bits and pieces to excuse their own particular situation.
Can the Christian who wants to engage someone on the issue of natural law, someone who denies it or is questioning it, can he avoid the God issue?
Not entirely. And this was tried, and mainly one of the reasons that natural law really fell out of favor. In the Enlightenment and the run-up to the Enlightenment, there was a lot of attempt to sort of push God and special revelation to the periphery in order to get a common ground that's being unclouded by, say, you know, political differences resulting from the Reformation and things of that nature. And the result of that entire enterprise was simply where we find ourselves today, that we cannot tell right from wrong and that we have no common ground at all. So ultimately, God is still necessary for justifying a natural law in terms of authority, that there is an authority to it that ought to be followed. He's needed for an ought to be in any way meaningful. Authority, it's something that we like to rebel against, but it's also something that most recognize as being conceptually valid. Even, you know, your typical extreme modernist is going to say that, take any, say, scientific controversy, say, evolution or global warming, you'll very often hear, you might not be able to understand this, but you should submit to these people who do understand because they have a kind of authority. Authority is something we recognize, and it's something that God provides to the idea of natural law. And even early in the Enlightenment, like, say, with Hugo Grotius, he realized this. His concept of natural law was very much because God created a world in which there is a natural law. But he still tried to distance himself, and ultimately we can't do that. One of the things that came out of the Enlightenment tried to create a lot of belief-neutral rubrics by which any person, any culture, any beliefs can follow and arrive at the same result. But, I mean, we can look around ourselves and find that that's not actually happened. One of the valid critiques of postmodernism is that we can't really be belief-neutral in the way we talk about value and theorize about value. And so we can't really be neutral about things like God either. Eventually, we do need to talk about that.
With only 30 seconds here, Matt, why is it worth continuing the conversation on natural law?
Well, because it helps to avoid having to make the mistakes of, say, utilitarianism, contractarianism, trying to reduce every moral facet to pleasure and pain or to consent. It matches our moral experience better than any of these reductionistic ethical systems. I mean, there are a lot of people out there who are being hurt regularly by people who say, well, you can do it as long as you want. You can do whatever you want as long as you don't hurt anybody. Somehow their hurt never really counts as hurt. Finally, we can count on it being there in the people that we converse with so that we can, if we know where to look, we can find common ground with which to have meaningful ethical conversations. And to help us recover the idea of recognizing right and wrong through intuition, through connaturality, and through the moral reasoning processes that God gave us to help engage those again.
Matt Cochran received his master's degree from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's authored a chapter in the book Natural Law. His chapter is titled A Way Forward, Continuing Conversations on Natural Law. You can purchase Natural Law by calling Concordia Publishing House, their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040, or you can find out more about natural law under the Listen On Demand page at issuesetc.org. Matt, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Pastor Bill Swirla about priesthood and ministry, two different things that always go together, the priesthood of all the baptized and the office of the holy ministry, both given as gifts to the church, to the same end, working together, but with unique calls, one to the church to proclaim the gospel, the other to the world to serve the neighbor. We'll be talking about that with Pastor Bill Swirla tomorrow on Issues Etc. Friday, we'll begin Issues Etc. 24, our live 24-hour, live continuous Bible study. We'll kick it off talking about the Book of Acts with Dr. Ken Sherb. Now, if you want to know the rest of the lineup for Issues Etc. 24 on Friday and Saturday, just go to our website, issuesetc.org. Watch the short YouTube video that we have posted there at our homepage. Issues Etc. 24 live from 4 in the afternoon Central on Friday through 4 in the afternoon Central on Saturday. You can listen live or you can listen on demand at issuesetc.org. We already have a bridge built. It is built in the human heart by that law written on the heart. It doesn't tell us much. It tells us right and wrong. It tells us that there is a God. It gives us an unmistakable testimony that there is a God who gives the rule of right and wrong. To find the Savior, we must go beyond what is written in the heart to what is written in God's holy word of Holy Scripture. And there we find that God who gave the law and who kept the law for us, Jesus Christ. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Good afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.